Okay, this is sound roll number 40 for Fight in the Field, it's a Paradigm production. We have minus 8 dB reference tone to follow on the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Here comes tone. Okay, this is the 28th of August. We're going to be interviewing Jerry Brown. We're in Oakland. We'll be starting camera roll 85, and we'll be starting with take number 1. So that's what's next.
But do they want to?
That's a good question. They wanted people to do it on $5 a week, and you can attract a certain kind of person on $5 a week, but not an administrator.
Okay, Rick, roll. Yeah.
Okay, this is take 1.
Jerry Brown. We're here to talk about your experiences and your thoughts about Caesar and the farmworkers, and the key to the whole thing is what you were able to do with his help and a lot of other people's help in getting the first farm labor law in the country passed. So if you just start a little bit by talking about what the significance of that law is and what that really accomplished.
The significance of the farm labor law is that for the first time, I believe, almost anywhere, maybe there's a country somewhere, but I don't know it, and nobody's brought it to my attention in the last 20 years, that actually is interested in giving power to farm workers. It just turns out that like garment workers and maids and people who do the grunt work, the backbreaking but essential labor so that we can eat food, have never really been represented. And I suppose the reason is because it's so easy to get people to do that kind of work that it's very difficult to organize them. And because they don't speak the language generally of the country, it's just very hard to do that. So the significance is that people at the bottom of what is now an increasingly stratified class structure, there emerged a militant, well-conceived, and well-articulated labor union. So, I mean, that far and away, that's the key point. At a time, of course, when organized labor was losing power on every front, other than the public sector, where, of course, there's some unusual advantages that don't exist in the private sector.
Well, let's back up a little bit from there. When did you recognize farm labor as an important issue, and when did you make a connection with the farm workers?
Sometime in the late 60s, I first came across Chavez when my father was running against Ronald Reagan for re-election in 1966. I met him very briefly, just walked through the house for a meeting with my father. And then later on, a couple of years later, I joined the march to Calexico, where the farm workers had a 13-mile march and then a meeting at the border that had a number of senators and Caesar speaking to the issue of the farm workers. That's where it started for me.
When we talk about the ALRB and the law and so forth, that came at the end of a whole sequence of events of farm worker victories and problems and people being killed. Do you have a sense, or can you give me a sense of how the idea for the law emerged and where the idea came from?
The idea had been around because there was a National Labor Relations Act. There had been discussions about including the farm workers under it. And then the idea, because there was the great boycott, and that was a very polarizing issue, different people had, I think even the growers had said, let's put this under the national law. Caesar didn't want that because he felt he was going to get caught up in the bureaucracy and what has turned out to be a very impotent set of rules at the federal level. So he had his own ideas for a state law. And there had been a bill. There was the Alatorre bill introduced in California, I believe, in 74. And maybe there had been some earlier efforts to get some kind of a labor law. Actually, it went back as early as the late 30s when the other Democratic governor, Governor Olson, proposed, I believe, some kind of a farm labor legislation. Maybe my father had presented something.
By 75, it became real. What was different then?
What was different then is, there's lots of stories on this that I'm not a precipient witness to all these things, but I believe that in return for financial assistance and whatever political and moral support, the National AFL CIO gave to Chavez and the farm workers, the leadership there extracted a pledge that he would support some kind of legislation. That was one point. And then the second, with the Teamsters entrenched with these sweetheart agreements with the growers, there was, I believe Caesar himself had the idea that a law might help. But it isn't clear, and I don't know if anybody can tell you precisely what the real thinking was. There's no doubt that Chavez came at some point to support a farm labor law. Whether he had serious misgivings about that or just mild misgivings, I don't know. But there was a reluctance going in. There was a period when he supported it. There was lawyers that worked for him that were certainly pushing that idea. And then the idea came to fruition in the context of 1975.
Now let's talk a little bit about the dynamic of how you pulled the law together. That was a very complex series of negotiations. And Jerry Cohen's position, for example, was that even though you were predisposed and helpful, that they still had to apply a lot of pressure to make it work. Is that how you saw it, or did you feel like you were working in sync with them? Or?
Well, in sync, and also at some arm's length. They liked pressure. They were from a battle. They were from the fields. They were from the boycott all over the country, and they were from the perspective that nobody's going to give the farm workers anything. They have to create the environment by which it comes to them, because other people have been pressured, intimidated, or in some other way pushed to do what Caesar and the farm workers wanted. Okay, that's where they're coming from. So they were pushing me, and obviously the powerful interests of the farm workers, the great people, the gallows. These are all significant players in the political process, not just because they have money, which they have, but also because there's a culture of solidarity in the media, among other businesses, the boosterism of the Central Valley, and it's a whole class of people who identify with a certain stability. Caesar's coming along and upsetting the old order of stability based on the idea that Mexicans are in a subservient position to pick the food, stay out of sight, not put a drain on public resources other than to give their labor and, in effect, subsidize low-cost food for the American consumer. I mean, that has been their historic role, and it's one of docility and manipulation. Now, Caesar comes along and says, hey, wait a minute. This is America. Everybody's equal, and we want our power. That was as revolutionary as any group in the world that has been in a suppressed situation, and it is experienced that way. But it was a revolution not just against some grower in Madera County, but against what I might call the oligarchy, the power establishment elite, the governing class. And as a politician, that's the class you have to please, because if you don't, you are then stigmatized as an oddball, a radical, weird, not playing by the rules, or out of step or out of sync, or something's wrong with you. And that's what happens and that's why, by the way, nobody supported the great boycott in Fresno, and only people in San Francisco that don't have any farmers, or in the middle of Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, they got a lot of support for the great boycott. But we're in the more marginal areas where the powers that be can have their will effectuated. Then Caesar was up against it, so that's why he had to pressure me, had to pressure the legislature, and had to create an environment wherein a law seemed preferable to disruption and chaos in the fields. That was the whole theory. And then, of course, added to that was economic pressure from picketing in the supermarkets and solidarity resistance on the part of labor unions in Canada, Scandinavia, Australia, and other places that could refuse to handle the farmers' produce. So this was not done, the farmers didn't want to do this because they had to yield power. And Chavez was basically saying, I want a docile group of semi-serfs to rise to the level of equal American citizens under the law and economically speaking. And now that hasn't happened to this day, but that's where he was coming from, and that was why his struggle was so difficult.
Well, but what I'm trying to get a sense of is when when you try and sit an Ernest Gallo and a Cesar Chavez down, are you dragging them to the table, or were you there and they were ready to talk?
No, they were ready to talk. They're ready to talk because of the trouble that basically Caesar and his allies could make for the farmers. If, absent that trouble, they would have never been there. It was just a matter of relieving them of unpredictability, work stoppages, or barriers to the distribution of their produce, and therefore their livelihoods and their profit. So it isn't clear, you know, I mean, that's what...
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 85, going to camera roll 86. Our next take is take two.
I know it's complex, but I'm saying is that you'll have one view of the complexity.
I seem to be sitting back a little bit more before, so let me move the chair a bit.
Okay.
There you go.
Are you okay on sound and stuff? By and large, I think it's too soon to say, really. We've got some contracts. Okay, shall we do this? Okay.
Okay, this is take two.
Yeah.
Marker.
Once the law was set up, the main unit that administers the law is the board. How do you sort of rationalize trying to be impartial, objective, and putting people like Leroy Chatfield and Roger Mahoney on, who are so obviously connected with the farm worker movement?
Well, I don't think, certainly Leroy was, but Johnson was, who also I put on, was connected to farmers directly. That was his occupation. He was a lobbyist for farmers and a farmer himself at one time. So,
I mean, let me put another
and way. Leroy had an existence prior to being a farm worker. He was a Christian brother. He worked for me. So that was a balance, those two. Then we had a lawyer, Joe Groden, who was, certainly he was sympathetic to workers. He was a labor lawyer. He would be viewed as an expert. Joe Ortega had nothing to do with the farm workers. He was someone I met when I was running for the junior college board. He was Hispanic, so I thought that would be something. There ought to be somebody with a Spanish surname who spoke Spanish on that board, given who the workers are. And he was a lawyer, and I believed he was somebody who was sympathetic. But he certainly had no real history of involvement. And then Roger Mahoney, I don't see how you can call him a partisan. He's a bishop. He's working with some of the most conservative people in Los Angeles today. He knew Gallo, he knew Jamara, he knew the growers, many of whom are Catholics, as well as Caesar and the farm workers. So I think that was just a canard. And they set rules, and the law was to give workers the power to choose for themselves. That's why they needed the access rule, why they needed have that thrust of the law to enable organization, to give workers some power. And these are workers that never had power. Many of them couldn't even vote because they weren't citizens.
Well, I mean,
and so I don't think the board was biased. I think that was a pure propaganda move. Now, Caesar did put a lot of pressure on the board and a lot of pressure on the general counsel to try to get rulings that he felt were favorable to himself. Now, you might wonder whether that was proper or not. You'd have to look into how that played itself out. But the board itself, I don't believe, was in any sense biased. It's far less biased than the Supreme Court appointed by the Republican governor that followed me, or the Farm Labor Board that was appointed after me. These were people who cared about the law, who cared about the principle of trade union democracy. That means you get to vote for or against, or for this union, not another union. Those were the principles. The people that were appointed after that were just fronting for the growers, for the class structure. And I use that word because there's now no doubt, as there was 20 years ago, even in the mainstream, that there is an increasingly class stratified society. And here, I really saw that between mostly Spanish-speaking. There were Filipinos, there were some Arab workers, but it was principally Mexican nationals who came over to pick our food, and they were treated as the stranger, as the alien, by these second and third generation Americans, many of whom were immigrants themselves, and because of that reason felt, hey, they had done it, and they were pretty tough on these people, and we needed a law, and that board, not in any sense biased, but I believe committed to the principle of equality and giving power to the powerless. And for that, I don't apologize one bit.
Okay. Well, I mean, do you think it's just the very fact that here was a board that was going to stick up for workers' rights, which had never happened before, that made people think it was a pro-worker board?
Right, because, of course, there was no consensus among or within the effective governing structure of California. The effective governing structure of California, if you take it as the large concentrations of capital, the trade associations, the lobbyists, but they're really employees, and the media. Positioning was threatened. What? I want to get a little more coffee while you're.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot.
And I'll have to take a sip.
Again, this is Sound Roll 41.
Yeah, and the real question is, can it be?
Hold on. Okay, so this is we're still on camera roll 86. Our next take will be take 3. We're continuing the interview with Jerry Brown, and we're back at 7.5 inches per second.
How much do you have on this one?
That's 200 feet.
Okay, great. Wonderful.
Turn again.
Okay, we have speed.
Okay, this is take 3. Marker?
Yep. Over the years, you developed a pretty good friendship and a personal relationship with Caesar. And as a politician, you also recognized the political impact of the union. In 76, when you made your bid for a presidential nomination, you asked Caesar to speak for you at the Democratic Convention. Why did you choose him to do that?
Because I felt he represented labor.
I'm sorry, can you start over? I chose Caesar because we need a complete statement.
I asked Caesar to second my nomination in 1976 for the Democratic nomination for president because I felt he was a very important historical figure. He represented a constituency that I worked with, that I wanted to support me, and I wanted to promote myself. I also had Yvonne Brathwaite Burke and the governor of Louisiana, so it was quite a rainbow there. Caesar definitely exemplified values that I believed in, and therefore I wanted to be associated with it.
From 76 on, the law is in effect. And in 76 and 77, there were a couple of farm workers had a couple of great years. They won hundreds of elections. And then something changed. And even before you left office, they had backed off on elections. What do you think happened?
Well, the law was defunded by the farmers putting pressure. And when I say the farmers, the corporate agriculture that has the lobbyists, the lawyers, the strategists decided to intimidate the legislature into withholding funding. That actually started in 76, and then it was closed down, and then with the threat of this popular ballot initiative, the measure was then refunded. I think that took a lot of the wind out of the sails. The original board collapsed, and we had to get a whole new board. Just the political climate changed to make it less favorable for winning elections and also for getting contracts, because becoming the bargaining agent, or even the certified bargaining agent, which could take several years after all the legal objections filed by the growers, there still was a need to get a contract. And that contract was very hard to hammer out with the reluctant grower. And the growers, of course, were encouraged by the sense in 1979, 1980. This is the emergence of Reaganism. It's the emergence of the virulent Cold War, anti-Russian rhetoric that was going to mobilize somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion in military spending, which is really a subsidy to very powerful corporate interests that were promoting it. And the growers are caught up in and a part of that whole operation. So they were emboldened to fight back and to undermine the law as best they could. Well, the law is only as good as its enforcement. You have a board that is packed by Duke Majian. Duke Majian got hundreds of thousands of dollars from farmers to change the law. They bought the dismemberment of the farm labor law. It's a felony. I mean, it's no doubt about it. Now, the law, they're not going to put Duke Majian in jail because the attorney general is elected that way. I was elected that way. The system runs on the felonious bribery of receiving money in return for official action. And that's what it is. Now, the Supreme Court has come down with a decision that says you got to prove an explicit quid pro quo, but it is there somewhere in somebody's mind, if not actually expressed. So once having bought a board and a general counsel favorable to the growers, then that certainly weakened Caesar. He also perhaps changed his focus, and that's something you'd have to talk to the union about.
Well, but I mean, given that you can always buy votes and so forth, looking back, was the law a good thing to do if it couldn't have any permanence?
That I don't know.
I mean, do you still feel that the law was the right way to go?
I don't know. Certainly, I like the law because it got me off the hook. I didn't have to say, oh, the great boycott. No, we have a law. We take it to a vote, and you have a secret ballot election, and that gets it off of my plate. And as a politician, we don't want controversy that divides the constituency. And as a matter of fact, I lost a lot of votes in the farm labor area, I mean, among the farmers. They liked me the first year. After that, I was, Typhoid Mary south of Sacramento. Now, that's a very self-interested view, but that is the view of a careerist politician, because unless you have that view, you can't run the gauntlet of electoral politics today, and that's kind of a view that I don't share at this point. So was the law right? Caesar needed a movement. His movement was drained of its, what's the right word? Its charisma or its enthusiasm by virtue of the domestication of the law. In fact, that was the argument I made to the growers. Once you get this into the structure of laws and appeals and transcripts and delays, I mean, you're not gonna have a problem. That was how I sold it to the growers, as a matter of fact. Now, Caesar knew that, but at that point, for all the various reasons, that was where he had to go. Now, would it have been better had he been able to build his movement and sustain it in some other way? Conceivably, it could have been better. I think he certainly, when he came to my house and talked to me before the bill was even introduced, he said, "Oh, I don't know about this law. I know as soon as it gets in there, the same economic powers will take it over, and then the farm workers will get screwed." That's what he said to me. I don't know the exact words, but that was certainly the import of what he said. And I thought, well, maybe he's just posturing to negotiate the best law he can possibly get out of me. But I also believe that really spoke from his heart, and he knew that the legal structure favors the status quo, and farm workers are not the status quo. They are marginal participants in the economy, even though by their labor, they're major contributors to all of our benefit.
I mean, the analogy is that the Voting Rights Act was the official end of the civil rights movement. Do you think there's a parallel?
Yeah, there could be. There could well be a parallel there. Because you see, basically, the goal of the of
we're going to stop.
Let's do that question again.
Yeah.
Let's do the parallel question again.
Good. We've got just a little more.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 86. 87 will be next. Our next take will be take 4.
He had a little plate in his head.
Yeah, no, I know. Okay.
Dorothy Day used to come. I met with one with her to the fields once. I picked.
Rolling.
This is take 4, Marco.
Who's starting up on?
Civil rights movement analogy.
Yes, parallels. Okay. Okay, let's go through that parallel again. Did the ALRB mean for the farm workers the same thing as the civil rights law did, the voting rights law?
Okay, well, yeah, the parallel is this, that as the civil rights laws became reality, more people are voting, more African Americans are elected to office. But the economic discrimination, the separation, the alienation, the separation of society, it's still there. And as far as the farm workers are concerned, yeah, they have their law, but there's a continuing stream of new workers that are desperate. As a matter of fact, now it's been with the neoliberal policies in Mexico that are breaking down the old protective structures, there's a pushing of Mexican workers across the border. And the American farmer, particularly in California, requires a steady flow of cheap workers. So that being the case, you give them a law, it's not going to make that much difference. You have to stop for the train.
Okay, that was take 4. Take 5's next.
That's what happened. That's the real message. I don't know if you can put that in your documentary for PBS. Probably won't allow that.
Just take 5, Mark.
let's start right there. We're talking about the fact that, Caesar had this ability to attract a brilliant, talented group of people, and then that worked, but they couldn't outlast the sort of the staying power of the organizations that he fought.
Yeah, Caesar had very bright people. There was a lot of enthusiasm. After the movie, the Harvest of Shame, there was an identity with farm workers, or at least their plight. And yet, capital, just patient capital, tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, in this country, in Mexico, and other parts of the world, is there and is growing. That's just more than can be overcome with one charismatic leader.
But he was a remarkable person. About or what went through your mind when you heard that he died?
I wish that I had seen him a couple months before, and I had begun to spend some time with him with a view toward working on some new arrangement, or cooperatives, a different kind of popular organization. And so I was very, well, I was just sad that I wasn't going to have that opportunity, wouldn't be around, because I felt that he did have a sense of the direction that we needed to go in. I really think he was on the right track. He didn't get there, didn't get to the promised land, neither did Martin Luther King. Nobody ever gets there, but he was, I think, had the right values for the time. Frugality, sharing, cooperative, sustainable, those are his values. And those are as more relevant today than even when he started, by far. Well, at first, a lot of people who were farm workers got economic sufficiency, got that leg up, and were able to have lives they would have otherwise never had a chance to. Kids go to college, buy a home, have a broader experience of life's potential. That happened to tens of thousands of people because of the United Farm Workers. No question about that. And he also set a model. That example is still there. It's going on. It's for people to look at the history, look at the current farm labor law, the current farm workers union, and that can be emulated. And that's a living treasury of human endeavor and heroic effort. And I believe it'll be followed. It'll be taken to another level at some point in the future.
So his death is sort of the end of the chapter, but it's not the end of the story.
All right. Well, everybody's going to die, so everybody carries the baton and then drops it, and somebody else picks it up. Until somehow some catastrophe happens and we don't do that anymore. But I don't think that's going to happen. So Caesar is definitely, first of all, he's the first Mexican leader, the first Latino personage that was a worldwide figure. There's no other person, even to this day, who's as well known as he is. Not a cabinet member in the Clinton administration, not a mayor, not a congressman. Hell, he was the leader coming out of the Mexican-American experience. And I don't see that being challenged anytime soon.
Do you think that put too big a burden on him, that he had to represent too much?
Maybe. I mean, it's pretty incredible. I know when you come from a humble background, and all of a sudden you're now a global figure, unless you have a very strong sense of yourself or some kind of spiritual practice or some structure that keeps you in line. I mean, even the popes are supposed to have a guy walking behind them when they're coronated, who says, thus goes the glory of the world, to keep him humble. So every leader, and he had a lot of power within his union, runs the risk of excess.
Let's go back one more comment. We may have said this, but I want you to sort of give me a sense one more time. Looking back on the law, and hindsight's always 20/20, but if you had to do it over again, would you do it the same way? Do you think there were some mistakes made in how it was designed or implemented, or was it really the right thing to do at the time?
No, I think the law was the right thing to do. There's no mistake, at least as far as I can see now. But if there isn't the power to support the law, then the law becomes ineffective. And the fact of the matter is, in whether it's Sacramento or Fresno or Modesto or the Coachella Valley or the Imperial County, the farm workers do not have the power that the growers have. The growers have lawyers, they have allies, they belong to golf clubs, they talk to editors of papers, the equipment sellers, the real estate brokers, the housing subdividers, Sunkist or Sun, whatever those international companies are that run the agriculture in many places. This is power. And then the banks, of course, and there is the problem. A mere law voted in by some legislators in Sacramento or Washington will not have the power on the ground. Who has the power on the ground? And that is the people with the bucks. I mean, that's where it's all wrapped up in that power. So you have to have a balance between economic equality and legal equality, or otherwise one gets absorbed by the other.
And apparently we still need a movement, or you need popular pressure, even if you have things like laws, don't you?
Well, the laws right now are well, sure. I mean, the laws are there as a formality. They're a superstructure on top of this vibrant reality, which we, for lack of a better word, call the economy. So how do you change that economy? It's getting more unequal. It's getting more assaultive of the environment. It's driving people crazy. And what's going to change it? Not the people in Congress. They're bought and paid for. Not the laws, because the judges themselves are very conservative, and most of them have been appointed by Reagan or Bush or Pete Wilson or one of those characters. So it's going to require a people's movement from the ground up based on a response to intolerable conditions combined with the wisdom of leadership and the social justice philosophy, which is always there. I mean, there's the American tradition of equality, Jeffersonian democracy, yeoman farmer, individualism, and then there is the morality of thousands of years of developing sense that every person is entitled to a definite measure of dignity, and that's not happening. Not in the city, not on the farms, and not even for the middle class in the way our lives have been trivialized and marginalized by the corporate structures that have become so inhuman.
Okay, this will be room tone for the interview with Mr. Brown. Okay, that's the end of room tone. And the end of the interview with Jerry Brown.
For?
Okay, that's the end of Sound Roll 41.
You look for an interview. The family resemblance is much, much stronger
yes.
than normal.
That's it.
Great.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
This is you guys
No.
Yeah, that's the end of the sound roll. Goodbye.